Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Hello, I'm coming to you for the first time from the great outdoors, Carmel Valley. It's quite a view here. I wish you could see it. There will be pictures posted so you can be properly envious. I'm here with a proprietor and vintner of Albatross Ridge. Garrett very kindly introduced me to this stunning property, and we're tasting some wines. We started with a Pet Nat, and I have to say, I am a pretty tough customer when it comes to Pet Nat. However, this is really a great example of this rather esoteric type of wine. So we'll just start in the very beginning. And ask, how in the world did you wind up here? I know your great-great-grandfather flew over this.
Yeah, great-grandfather.
Great-grandfather. Flew over, you know, during, what was it, like 80, 90 years ago?
Oh, yeah, so 19, right? pretty much, it's coming on 90 years. Wow. we were in the early 1930s. He launched his Albatross sailplanes up here with Charles Lindbergh.
Oh, wow.
And he started at Fish Ranch on the coast, and then flew and then continued to launch throughout Carmel Valley. Mm-hmm. And him and Charles Lindbergh had actually worked on the Spirit of St. Louis together. And
wow.
He was the lead designer, my great-grandfather, of the Spirit of St. Louis. And so we knew all that history of him and Lindbergh working together and becoming friends and flying gliders and airplanes together, but we never knew that they launched them right in, you know, Carmel Valley, where we ended up planting the vineyard. And we had no family connection to this place that we knew of when we moved down here. We moved down here from Oregon, my wife and I working in the wine industry up there, and fell in love with this area because it was kind of, not to say unknown, but it was just, from wine perspective, kind of, I'd say more larger scale wineries operated in the area, and we saw a little opportunity here where you could perhaps, you know, eventually start our own label, sourcing some fruit. We ended up, though, kind of by chance, stumbling on this property about 6 months after we moved down here, and then our family all went in and got together and purchased the property in late 07.
Wow.
So.
I can see why you fell in love with this. This is really, words fail to describe how majestic this spot is. So in Oregon, were you making Pinot Noir and Chardonnay?
I was working for other people, but I wasn't making my own. So I was really just a cellar rat, and a cellar hand in the wineries. And then also, in the off season, I worked in tasty rooms. So it's kind of, I got to see all, avenues of the kind of wine industry. And so I kind of fell in love with Pinot Noir and Chardonnay from being in Oregon, and Pinot Noir in particular. And I kind of got my background history in terms of where I kind of studied. I got the bug when I was in college at UCLA, just drinking cheap wine with friends around. And so I think our average ball price was, you know, $4 to $6 or something. And we one night we splurged and got like a $20 ball of wine, and we shared it. And we go, oh, this is really good. It's from the south of France. Oh, let's plan a trip to France sometime. That would be amazing if we could do that. So I ended up having a girlfriend who was a Francophile. And she helped me find a course through the University of Davis through an extension program to go study winemaking and viticulture in Dijon and Burgundy.
Wow.
So that's kind of how that all came together, and kind of by kind of fate that just like, I just go, okay, I guess I'll take that. I was a water polo player and had retired in college because of ear problems. So it was okay, I've never thought I'd do this, but I'll try it out. Why not? And I immediately fell in love with the culture and the food and wine kind of culture and the pairing of food and wine that goes on in the different regions of France, and where they kind of grow together out of the history of those areas, and then kind of the connection with the history of all the, you know, kind of, you know, the history of France, Germany, Italy, all that. I was a big history buff back then and still am. And so I kind of fell in love with the kind of a history of wine. And I always love that book I think Hugh Johnson wrote, A History of Wine.
Yeah.
It's probably one of my favorite books.
Wow.
Besides wine or anything, it's a great book.
You're so right when it comes to wine that there is just thousands of years of history and such a great human connection. If you think about older wines, how many hands touched it so long ago and how it's becoming this source of pleasure but also intellectual stimulation unlike any other beverage. So I can see your attraction.
Oh, yeah. It's exciting. And seeing, too, the little microclimates popping up in kind of the new world and also in the old world too,
yeah,
where people are kind of challenging kind of the status quo stuff, but also you know, drawing on some of the historical stuff and the way wines were made in the past as well.
Yeah.
So I think it's an exciting time to live and be in the wine industry where you have this historical connection, documentation, but we also have, you know, clear, you know, science that we can use. You know, we used to think not too long ago, a lot, even, you know, back in Europe, a lot of people joke, hey, when we talk to winemakers, they go, oh, my father thought the wines would, you know, get softer and more delicate after Easter. Because,
yeah.
You know, and they go, well, that was really malolactic fermentation had completed. But, you know, now we do everything kind of native mallows, native yeast, and so we're able to kind of do stuff in a way, the old school way, but also use the technology to make sure everything's kind of sanitary in the cellar and make sure those things will go through completion without issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's kind of always the goal, is kind of keep it as clean and simple in terms of our winemaking, and kind of say like a, you know, a traditional route, but definitely try to have as little hands of a winemaker as possible, mm-hmm, in the process and you know, using not too much sulfur,
yep,
at bottling. And really our Chardonnays, for example, go through full ml natively and don't usually get sulfur, depending on the vintage, until 8 to 9 months in barrel sometimes.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, we're trying to really keep stuff as simple as possible, as clean, as to kind of show the pristine, you know, kind of land up here that we have,
mm-hmm,
and really the expression of the soil and that kind of coastal microclimate.
Yeah. Are those values the ones you kind of brought from Dijon? Or?
Yeah, it was kind of funny. I got to taste a bunch of wines there and really, frankly, had no foundation where to put them on in terms of, oh, well, I've already knew this producer from,
yeah,
when I tasted in San Francisco at this trade event. I had, you know, I was, mm-hmm, raw to a degree where, you know, we were, you know, I had studied a lot just to get my feet wet and understand what I was going to be getting into, mm-hmm, in terms of book study, but I had really no experience tasting a lot of Burgundy wines in the past, really.
Mm-hmm.
I brushed up on it, obviously, a, mm-hmm, little before, but I didn't have the resources or the connections to really go too deep in that at first.
Mm-hmm.
So that class, really, we were there for about 3 months almost, and we got to taste every day and go vineyard visits, winery visits, several times a week. And so that was really kind of a foundation for me. So my palate was almost trained and built around, mm-hmm, those being the first wines that I kind of looked at, studied, and go, well, what's unique about this? Okay. And it was kind of from a really a naive perspective in a way. So I had no clue what I was getting myself into. I didn't go, oh, I'm going to do this so I can go into wine. I was just kind of, let's just go enjoy the trip.
Yeah.
And immediately after first few weeks, I was going, okay, this is really cool. I would love to somehow be involved in this industry, which I figured, like, you know, sales and marketing, that would be kind of where I would like end up.
Mm-hmm.
And then the more I met the different family businesses that we met, Nomura is going, this is really amazing that they've been able to pass this business down generation to generation.
Yeah.
You know, somewhat, some were unbroken, some were very intertwined with different marriages and being passed on through different parts of family, which was fascinating in itself too, the family trees.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of places had these cool pictures with the family trees and the names of the people that went before. And I was just kind of very fascinated with that. It kind of struck a chord with me.
I bet.
That you could have this, you know, multi, really not even generation, we're talking multi, you know, centurial family, family business.
Yes, for history buff, it was paradise.
It was paradise, yeah. So that's what got me. And then these wines were, I kind of felt, to me, coming back, the IOPI experience was trying to kind of try wines from California or Oregon or mm-hmm. other Pinots that were highly rated, and then being not really let down on it, but mm-hmm. being like, okay, this is like tastes more like a really big Pinot, or almost like a Syrah to me, or mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of wrapping my head around that, where you go, okay, these wines are definitely different than the ones I had in Burgundy. And throughout France, really, in terms of the alcohol level and the role that the acid structure played in the wines to me, that I felt like always stood out, and the freshness of the wines when you were eating them with food. You almost felt like, hey, you know, a red Burgundy, even though it's a little light and it's, you know, in color, it could still go with a Côte de Bœuf or, you know, a really... nice rack of lamb, even though mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people here would go, oh, you gotta do a Syrah or a Cabernet with that. But to me, having that freshness and acid, I always gravitated towards Pinot Noir and Chardonnay because of that, you know.
No, that makes perfect sense. You also highlighted the cleanliness in the cellar. I know the great master Andrew Chalicha certainly held that as a top value.
Yes.
He really changed the California wine scene. That was part of the fundamentals that he instilled. Important to you.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where if you want to make really good wine, doing the kind of some of those old school practices, even though we're blessed with tons of technology and we can go, hey, this barrel has some VA, this has this, and we can test for a ton of stuff now before it even gets there on the you know, on the notes of the nose and stuff.
Yep.
You can really track stuff really well with going native yeast and going native mallow and not adding a bunch of sulfur. The other thing about that is if your cellar's not clean, you're going to have stuff all over the place in terms of quality year to year. And then you're also going to have, issues that arise after, you know, bottling, where you're going, okay, well, this tasted good the first couple of years, what happened? So when you don't put a lot of sulfur in the wine, that's a risk you take. And one of the ways we mitigate that is trying to keep stuff spotless where we've been making wine.
Do you aspire to make wines that are age-worthy? Is that one of the things
that's really the goal. Our goal is to make them, you know, always since I started kind of drinking wine, I was never kind of fascinated at first going, okay, well, this is a really old wine. I only want to drink a lot of old wines. I want to have stuff that can drink now, but also age.
Yeah.
As I've developed over the years and tasted a lot more old wines and a lot of, you know, different varieties of older wines, I've become kind of really fascinated in how those vintages are produced, where you can, you know, get that one wine from, one producer, and the exact same producer from a different vintage. What's the difference? Obviously vintage, but did they do something, you know, just a little different in the cellar?
Yeah.
Or was it stored differently? You know, there's a lot of variables there.
Sure.
But I think when you look at ageability, we kind of look at stuff. Our goal is to have the acid be nice and fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Have some tannin structure there in the Pinot, which we achieve with doing some whole cluster, good amount of whole cluster, and then having the alcohols be, you know, moderate, so the wine still tastes fresh, years from now. I'm not trying to say, hey, our wines are going to last 20, 25 years, but I'd like them to be, I'd like to think we're making them that they can, you know, be cellared and be drunk, you know, 10 to 12 years, 13, 14 years from vintage and be still pretty vibrant.
Very cool. On the vineyard side, I was looking at the back label of your bottle, and I hope I'm going to pronounce this next word right. Diatomaceous.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, yeah.
So diatom is the root of the word, and it's an ancient seabed, is that correct?
That's essentially, yeah. It's as we sit here, we're about 1,250 foot elevation.
Goodness.
And so, you know, all this ridge really is old seabed. It's all uplifted seabed. There's a fault line that actually goes through the property.
Okay.
And there's, down below, there is completely different shift in the kind of soil structure. It goes from the uplifted diatomaceous seabed, mm-hmm. and then it slowly kind of pulls through into a loam and then into a granitic base down in the lower pasture.
Wow.
There. So that's what kind of excited us too about this property, was that the opportunity long term to be able to plant on, you know, two different soil types in a way, with running, having this fault line go through.
So it must be challenging to plant here, though.
Yeah, it was a pain in the ass. it was a lot of hand digging.
Yeah.
For pretty much, you know, when you go plant, the idea is, hey, we can shovel out a hole really quickly, and then, you know, the group or persons following the people shoveling the holes can plant and put the soil and really tamper down, get the air out of the soil and make sure, you know, the roots get, you know, enough room, but they're not too compacted, but, you know, not mm-hmm. too much room. And the struggle with here was that there was so much rock. It's about 85% to 95% rock.
Yeah.
Depending on where you are in the vineyard.
Yeah.
And we did about 150 pits throughout the whole property, so we got a really good look on what the soil profiles were. And, mm-hmm. and essentially, you know, the more you drag or till, you just bring up more rock. There's just rock everywhere. And so it made it a challenge to plant, and we were able to get a pretty good take. We still had like a 95% take for the vines.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, so, and we just took our time. It wasn't, you know, we didn't, anyone, when they come up here and see all the work that has to be done, they go, oh, that's a lot of work, and it is, but we're never kind of rushing around. We're always trying to just kind of diligently, methodically take care of what we're doing, because you can't rush up here. There's, you know, it's steep ground, and then from pruning to, you know, replanting, everything just takes 2 to 3 times longer than it does for a normal vineyard, because it's not really flat ground most of the spots. So
Again, look at your back label. There's a lot of disclosure here. There's, of course, the vineyard elevation, 1,250 feet, and I can definitely tell there's a whole other microclimate here.
Yeah, this is the wind. This is our problem that we deal with on a yearly basis, is you can get a ton of wind at your least opportune time. So we've had, this is the most promising year we've had in terms of what we feel like a growing season,
mm-hmm.
probably since we've been up here, in terms, mm-hmm. you know, when you look at the soil profile and the amount of water we've had a good amount of rainfall, a ton of rain this year compared to the last you know, several years. I mean, at least mm-hmm. 4, at least 5 years. What's nice is we have, you know, essentially a normal season. Usually up here we have such a long growing season, but a lot of that, obviously, we pick really late, in late September, late into late October, but we have bud break can be in mid-February sometimes.
Wow.
So that was basically the last 4 years. Pretty much 4 vintages were early bud break. And what happened was we had that wind still in the springtime, and everything decided to bloom a little early. So it would be, you know, like weather like this, a little warmer, and then it would turn, you know, the vineyard right into bloom, you know, starting in sometimes mid-April.
Wow.
Into late May, and you ended up all of a sudden having 60-degree weather, 70-degree weather, and breezy, but then all of a sudden it would go to 52 for like a week and be cold and windy and not a lot of sun. So that would shut down the pollination, and we end up losing about, you know, anywhere from 30 to some vintages up to 80% of the fruit.
Wow, that's painful.
Yeah, so this year, we know we're hopefully out of the woods, because the closer we get to June, for the growing season in terms of pushing bloom and flowering that much later, the better we are. And so this is kind of the first year that we've had that, so it's awesome.
Yeah, no, again, just studying the label, I really love it. It gives you so much intel right there. The vines per acre, so density obviously is really important. And then you also cite the yields, and the harvest is quite long, 5th to 24th of September on this particular Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty
staggered
harvest.
Yeah, it was a long, drawn-out harvest.
Yes. And again, interesting note, 33% of new French oak. It's very precise, 33%. So it's about a third is what
you use. Roughly a third. Okay. We try, you know, it's one of those things where year to year, We don't feel like we were trying to do the same there was never a formula. I came up here with the idea that the more people I talk to with in terms of winemaking and working for different people and helping make their wines, I realized that every winemaker has his own kind of ethos and own kind of things that he likes that other people might not like, and kind of and really preferences and beliefs. So I kind of feel like up here we wanted to start with a clean slate and go, okay, we want to make wines that are true to the soil, true to the microclimate, and showcase what this you know really special spot is. And the way to do that was not to kind of go off one way or the other. Go, okay, we're not going to do any new oak, or okay, we're going to do 100% new oak, you know, and really kind of keep it simple in the winemaking perspective.
Yeah.
Because I felt like that would give us the ability to play around, not having kind of like a huge dogma there that we're going to, you know, make the wine very stylistically similar to this winery or what this consultant says or stuff like that. So,
you know, I love that philosophy. You obviously not tether like some other parts of California, you know, people pretty much are obligated financially to plant certain, you know what I'm referring to.
Oh, yeah.
let's name it, you know, Napa, like the economic reality is a Cabernet.
Yeah.
And the land is so costly and such like that, you can ill afford to experiment a whole lot, unless you just have unlimited resources, both land and money-wise, and that's just not the case. So it always struck me, you know, about Central Coast and such like that, that people here have the freedom to really not just get to know the vineyard, but really kind of work with it, like you said, at their own pace and not feel rushed and feel a ton of pressure.
No, that's a really good way to put it, because we talked to different, you know, people and consultants, and what we kind of came back with was going, okay, it's funny, we just talked to 10 different people and they all had 10 different opinions. So,
yeah, of course.
You know, not saying none of those opinions are valid, and a lot of them, you know, were great opinions and great ideas, and we incorporated a lot of people's different ideas. But what we kind of came up with was going, okay, we're going to make, you know, wines that are true to the vineyard and true to the area. And our first vintage, 2010, was only a small fraction of the vineyard in production. We kind of actually wanted to pick a little riper, believe it or not. And we just couldn't because we had rain coming, and it was late October, and we couldn't get the vines in September even to change color all the way. And so we had to drop fruit down to about a half a ton per acre. And we only ended up making about from, you know, these two blocks of Pinot right here side by side.
Yeah.
And then the first two little blocks of Chardonnay, about 100 cases of each wine of Chard and Pinot. And the rest of the vineyard we had another year of just kind of growing. Mm-hmm. And we ended up picking about 22 bricks for the Pinot. And about a little less for the Chardonnay, like 21 and a half to 22. And we kind of were hoping to get more like in the 23 and a half range, still lower in alcohol, but like, you know, 13 and a half or And what ended up happening was a rainstorm came through and we said, all right, it's going to be raining tomorrow, definitely we're picking. So we gathered the amount of people we needed and we picked immediately that morning. It wasn't a lot to pick. but it really kind of, after tasting those wines, they were young vines. They just tasted so fresh and vibrant with that alcohol, which was right around 12.5 to 12.8 alcohol and really balanced. So from that day forward, we said, okay, we're going to kind of let the season kind of dictate, you know, our picking decisions and the taste of the vine and also the numbers, you know, the pHs. Yeah. And if the pHs are ready where it's going to be picked, we need to pick them. You know, maybe if the bricks aren't where we want them, a little higher, but the pH is there where it needs to be picked, so we don't have to acidulate and do a whole lot of additions. That's what we need to, you know, that's what we need to do is kind of follow that on the freshness of the wine. And when the grapes are ripe, they're ripe when you know the acids are balanced, not when the bricks hit a certain, you know, degree. You know,
it's so interesting to hear you use the word fresh. I know in Europe that's a huge value.
Oh yeah.
Every winery I've ever gone to, that's where the conversation typically starts. We like fresh. It's a relatively new kind of a big deal in the U.S. But you seem to really kind of hone in on that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're, it's funny, I think the more winemakers get to travel, even from Europe to here, I've had people from Burgundy come and come to the property and visit, and they were just blown away with just the Central Coast and the Sonoma Coast and all the kind of freedom that we have here to play around with stuff and doing different varietals, even besides Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, and kind of that interplay where you talk to different winemakers, and everybody comes back to is the more wine they drink, the more they kind of like things more cleaner, simpler, and fresher, because you know it's kind of stripping away what's, you know, something that has so much oak that you have to lay it down for, you know, 14, 15 years, just so you're like, okay, I don't need to, you know, open up and smell, you know, a giant cigar box every time I, you know, take a sip of this wine, or stuff where, you know, you go, I want to be able to drink, you know, a wine that can go with a bunch of variety of different foods.
Sure.
And that comes, to me, that's that interplay of, you know, acid and structure, and then having stuff that's vibrant and not too heavy on the palate, which, you know. It's kind of, I don't know, I think that's a lot to do with just being exposed to that for those first wines that I was drinking.
Yeah.
And really actually studying and kind of really falling in love with, but, it's certainly, I think the wine industry is moving that way in a lot of parts. And I think the consumers' palates are moving that way too, as they get more introduced to just wines all over the world and new little growing regions and wineries.
No, agreed. And you're obviously making a pretty meaningful contribution here. This is cooler climate wines. I just took a sip of the Chardonnay, and there's definitely some energy and tension happening there, which I love, and beautiful minerality. So we're tasting 2014 at the moment of Albatross Ridge Estate Chardonnay. And again, folks, when you buy this wine, which I'm pretty sure you're going to want after listening to this, it's delicious, and there's so many little factoids in the back, a little mini story of the brand. And again, the elevations, the planting density, the harvest, which again was 2 weeks, and light hand on the oak treatment, 25% new. The rest is used. So the wine actually is, to reiterate, is quite fresh.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.